You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan. And this is episode 47, covering the week of October 17th through October 21st, 2016. Glad to have you back on the program. We got a lot of good stuff to talk about this week. And again, as usual, if you are listening to this podcast and you are enjoying this podcast, and please share it on social media. We need the support from people like you. And the only way to get that is for people to hear it and know what we're doing. So like us on Facebook, like us on Twitter, or follow us on Twitter, I should say. Follow us on YouTube and share our material online. And also, if you're liking this podcast and you are so inclined, please make a tax-deductible donation to the Abbeville Institute. We exist on your generous contributions alone, so help us keep the lights on, help us keep the podcast going, the website going, and all the programs we want to do for you, including our wonderful summer school and other educational opportunities, which we will have several of those coming up in 2017. So please help us out. Next month, actually, November is nonprofit month, so we are going to be doing a lot of advertising and hopefully getting you to donate to our cause. So you can go to abbevilleinstitute.org, A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E, institute.org, and click at the top where it says support and go to memberships for individuals and help us out. For less than $5 a month, you can help the Abbeville Institute explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Okay, well, that said, we actually are going to talk a little bit about the Southern tradition this week, the political tradition of the South. And so almost every piece, well, actually every piece this week, did have something in that regard to it, and what makes the South unique in that particular way. And this is something that we are quite interested in at the Institute. And in fact, I think that it's probably the most important component of the Institute is the Southern political tradition and how that can benefit the United States moving forward, or simply benefit the South moving forward. But for now, we're talking about the entirety of American history and the entirety of the American experience. So the Southern political tradition is important in that. And the first piece for the week by Paul Yarbrough, entitled "It Probably Won't End Well," focuses on how modern conservatives forget the importance of the South and what they identify as conservative. And the second piece of the week does that exact same thing. And so Yarbrough is talking about a piece that was published in Town Hall or townhall.com entitled "Liberal Attempts to Silence Dissenters Will Not End Well." And so he said Yarbrough was attempted at the end of the piece to comment saying that, the real problem here is that people forget that the entire situation we're facing in America today was born out of the fact that Lincoln and the Republicans won the war, and that the South was the one true block to this nationalistic Hamiltonian agenda that was foisted on the entire United States during the 1860s and beyond. And of course, he mentions that anytime you say this, though, any critique of Abraham Lincoln or the Republican Party will land you immediately in the ostracized room of every online chat room or online message board. You're going to be shunned because you dare to say that maybe the South had a point and maybe the South was right in their advocacy of states' rights and independence. Because without that, there's no way that you can check this federal Leviathan from the state. And this is exactly what Jefferson and was saying in 1798. Same thing with Madison, even though he went back and forth on this issue over his life. But this is exactly what they're saying, or Calhoun was saying. Any of the states' rights advocates, even those in the North, were saying this. If you look at the history of quote-unquote states' rights thought, beginning in 1794, Northerners were advocating secession. They did so in 1800, or actually 1801, 1803, 1815. They were advocating, abolitionists were advocating secession in 1848. So if you can't use the state to check the central authority, that is the fourth leg of the table that holds up American government. You've got the three branches, and then you've got the states, which is the fourth leg, and actually the strongest leg and the most substantial leg. So if the states can't do their job, then there's no way to check this power. And of course, Southerners held on to this tradition longer than anyone else and were better vocal advocates of it than Northerners. So when anytime you say, look, you know, maybe the South had a point. Maybe we need to start talking about the Southern political tradition as conservatives and not just get caught up in this knee-jerk reaction to the South. Oh, well, yeah, everything in the South was just about race. It's not true. And so I think that this is something that we're trying to do at the Institute is promote this idea that, you know, Southern political ideas still have currency. And that we need to stop, and the worst really are the conservatives when you start saying this. The left is going to hate us anyways, but conservatives, particularly those of the neoconservative bent, are problematic. Because if you can't say, well, look, maybe the South has something to offer here. Well, no, you can't say that. Only the great heroes of the conservative movement are in the North. We've got John Adams. We've got George Will, and those are the people we're going to listen to. We got Abraham Lincoln, great conservative. So therein lies the problem, and of course Hamilton is the major hub that everything revolves around in this entire issue. In fact, you know, you could say Hamilton was probably the most important man in American political history. George Washington, most important man in American history. But Hamilton, close second. Of course, Washington was particularly in his second term, was very much under Hamilton's influence. So I think you can say without a doubt, Hamilton. George Will was right when he said we live in Hamilton's America. But this particular piece is essential because it does point that out. So I think you should take a look at this piece. He does, again, reiterate that what we are looking at here, if you try to silence the South, you are causing problems for the future of conservative thought in America. And that's not something that most people realize. And this bridges us into the second piece of the week, which was excellent by Ryan Walters. And Ryan has written a lot of good stuff for us recently. And this particular piece is entitled Jeffersonian Conservatism. And he asks the question, what is true conservatism? And he says, look, it's more about the South and Jeffersonianism than it is anything else. So this gets into that idea that Jefferson was a conservative. And that, of course, is a very controversial opinion because Jefferson is always often viewed as a radical, particularly in his own state of Virginia. He was not someone like John Randolph of Roanoke. His views were not in line with the conservatives of the state of Virginia. But Jefferson's commitment to real federalism makes him a conservative American. And of course, his commitment to his own people, his own state, which is Virginia, and which he called his country, that makes him an American form, a form of American conservative. So I think that we've talked about this on the program before. The importance of the Jeffersonian tradition cannot be overestimated. If we seek to regain any type of traditional America, it has to come from a Jeffersonian view of the world and of America itself. And so Ryan does a very good job of pointing out the dichotomy between Hamilton's America and Jefferson's America, between Hamilton's Constitution and Jefferson's Constitution. They're two different things. Now, this is not to say that Jefferson was the most profound thinker of the Jeffersonians. I think you could say that John Taylor of Caroline was a much better political thinker. A lot of the old Republicans were much better thinkers and activists, political activists, than Jefferson himself. But Jefferson is the symbolic head of this group of people, and so we call it Jeffersonianism. And of course, when you look at what they believed in, whether it's limited government, which is federalism, sound money, low taxes, and tariffs, no national debt, government separation from banks, no support for corporations or big business, a strict construction of the Constitution. These are all the things that Walters points out, including the protection of civil liberties held by the people and a non-interventionist foreign policy. As Walter says, simply put, the Hamiltonians believed in the merits of government. Jeffersonians trusted in the people to govern themselves. But that commitment to federalism really is the important issue. It's a commitment to the idea that the ratifiers of the Constitution, when they said, look, you don't worry about the federal government because we can't do anything that the Constitution does not authorize us to do. You know, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, standing at the Philadelphia State House, which is now called Independence Hall, right after the ink had barely even dried on the document, standing out there in his State House yard speech saying, you know what, trust us, if it doesn't say we can do it, we can't do it. And that is virtually how every proponent of the Constitution sold the document moving forward in 1787 and 1788. And the Jeffersonians just held on to that idea longer. They said, this is what you told us the Constitution would be. And of course, within 2 years after the document's ratified, you've got Hamilton backtracking on that, and then, of course, the Supreme Court codifying that. So this is the key to understanding American conservatism, that commitment to federalism. This is what the Abbeville Institute is all about in terms of our political advocacy. Now, we don't talk about parties or candidates, but we do push the idea that what we need is real Jeffersonian federalism in America, because that is the only way, that is the only way you're going to preserve any type of the American tradition. And it will help the North too. They have their own political traditions. They have their own culture, their own society. It will help them to preserve that. Of course, as Walters points out, that's not really necessarily what they want to do. They want to expand their interest. They want to be imperialistic. And their culture is alien to the South. Now, Southerners, I think, have done a good job, and this is not something to be proud of, but they've done a good job of absorbing American culture, New England culture, and making it part of Southern culture. And that's because they wanted to be accepted after the war. I think that's very clear when you start looking at the Spanish-American War of 1898, World War I, and how Southerners just wanted to be accepted again. But accepted they wouldn't be, ever. They're always going to be the whipping boy. They're always going to be the other. And when anything goes wrong, well, it's the South that's the problem. We got to focus all of our ire and attention on the South, because anything that is wrong with America to the New England mind, the Yankee mind, has to come out of the South. And so when you look at modern political thought, it's the South that's always problematic. And of course, you know, the idea, you know, better off without them. Maybe we should, you know, people think, liberals think we should just put a fence around the South and keep the Southerners down there and we'll have the rest of the United States to ourselves. Well, Southerners would say, well, we tried that in 1861. You wouldn't let us do it. So we've got, as Walters points out, really two different worldviews, a northern worldview and a southern worldview. And right now, the northern worldview is dominant. It has been since 1865. They control the history, they control the government, they control the economic system. There have been spurts where the South has had some influence, and I'll talk about that in the last piece of the week. But for the most part, it doesn't matter which party you're talking about, the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. It's been dominated since really the late 19th century or early 20th century by Northern worldview. And Ryan Walters believes that, you know, Cleveland was the last guy to really advocate this Jeffersonian Southern conservatism. And he says that the Panic of 1893 killed Jeffersonian conservatism for good, as Republicans successfully spun it as a Democratic Depression, which seemed plausible when prosperity returned under McKinley. So he says, to get around that label, Democrats began shedding Jeffersonian principles and began embracing more Hamiltonian ideas. By the early 20th century, one disgruntled Jeffersonian Democrat wrote that the old party, as we knew it, is dead. Now, I'm going to point out, when you get to the Progressive Era and you get to the Woodrow Wilson administration, and now Ryan says in 1912, after 16 years in the political wilderness, Democrats managed to rebuild and elect Woodrow Wilson, but even though he had Southern roots, he was no Jeffersonian. His two terms showed him to be more progressive than any president since Lincoln, a trend that has continued for the last century. Yes, this is very true. But I think the Southerners in the Congress were doing things, if you look at what they wanted, their agenda, they were simply using the apparatus that was given to them to try to beat back this Northern dominance of American economy and society. And I'll talk about that with the last piece of the week. I said this last week, and I'm going to double down on it because I had a commenter say, "How you're crazy for saying this." No, it's true. We may not like what they were using to do it, but I think some of that comes out of our worldview, thinking, well, you know, we've adopted this much more northern view of some things at times. But I'll get to that in a minute. So it's an excellent piece. You should pull it up, take a look at it. Ryan Walters, Jeffersonian Conservatism. All right. On Wednesday, we had another great piece by Clyde Wilson from what used to be the Clyde Wilson Library. We've just kind of merged that into the blog. And it's the title is Goodbye, George. And he has a great quote to begin it by Chilton Williamson. An American president can wreck his country and blow up the world, but he cannot recreate either of them. And this is a highly critical hit piece of George W. Bush. And he says, quote, "If Americans learn nothing else from the Bush fiasco, assuming they are able to learn anything, it should be never again to elect a spoiled brat to high office." I mean, we should think that in 2016. This is the Bush legacy. And he says, perhaps George's most lasting accomplishment is the discrediting of Christianity as a political force in America. It is assumed that his strong support came from evangelicals with whom he pretended kinship. Liberal commentators like to imagine that Christians conspire to impose a Puritan reign of terror on the country, and so pundits and historians will continue to write about the evil domination of the Bush administrations by Christians. But of course, this is to mistake the facts as usual. This is where he gets into the beautiful part of this essay, which is bashing the Republican Party. The fact is, quote, that the Republican Party has always dictated to the organized evangelicals, but they have never dictated any Republican act or policy of significance. In the 1960s, George Wallace showed the vote-getting potential, the social issues, something which no Republican had the insight or daring to do. But the party did see the potential votes from silent majority rhetoric. And so the leaders of the organized evangelicals were seduced by pretenses of fellowship and shared values. Okay, so this is really interesting. You look at a modern political movement, the modern Republican Party, you do have large numbers of evangelicals in the Republican Party because that's the only place they thought they could go. They really don't fit in the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party doesn't share their views openly. The Republican Party gives lip service to it, but oftentimes doesn't do anything about it. That is one thing that, the Trump phenomenon has really captured that. He is not just giving lip service, he's saying, I'm going to do these things. And people believe him because, Trump is genuine. I mean, you can honestly believe what he's saying. Now, whether he's going to deliver or not, no one knows. But this is the one part of the attractiveness of Trump is the social agenda of the Trump phenomenon, which is, we're going to focus on making America great for middle-class Americans again and sharing middle-class, dominant middle-class values. And when you look at the polling numbers by, data when it comes to different people and who supports Trump, that's generally where he's getting support. Strongest among blue-collar, middle-class Americans. So Americans need to think about that, particularly evangelicals, when they keep voting Republican and pulling the lever for Republicans. Do these Republicans really share your values? As Yarbrough said, it probably won't end well. If we don't start focusing on the South and Southern values, it's not going to end well for anything. The South is the heart of real American conservatism, as Ryan Walters pointed out, and of course, as Clyde is saying here, real American conservatism real Southern conservatism has a very strong religious bent to it, but we need to stop pulling the lever for the Republicans all the time because Republicans have never represented the South. He says, concludes, but of course the Republican politicians generally hold in contempt the Christian groups and their concerns, a minor distraction from their pursuit of power and profit. They have had zero impact upon Republicans in power. These are evangelicals. The last believing and practicing Christian in the White House was Jimmy Carter. Given the disgrace brought down by the faith of Bush, there will probably never be another. Well, we haven't had one for 8 years, and if Hillary Clinton wins, we won't have one again. And you could say, you know, is Trump really that Christian? At least I think people believe he's genuine, saying he's going to push for social values that he finds out of Christianity that he finds important. So we'll see. And that said, the piece on Thursday by Stephen Borthwick, Orthodoxy, Orthodox Christianity and Southern Identity, he talks about, so you have evangelicals, and then you have this other large block of Christians in the South, Orthodox Christians, whether they're Catholics or members of the Eastern Orthodox Church, they are a different type of Christian, but they are so important to the Southern tradition because they believe in tradition. And he says, Borthwick says, Orthodoxy finds itself suited in a strange way to the South. In the highest rungs of Virginia's young aristocracy, the seed of Orthodoxy first found good ground and brought forth fruit. And he says, today, while Orthodoxy remains statistically underrepresented in the whole of the South, many of those who have crossed the Bosphorus and the River Bug belong to a burgeoning intellectual class who actively engage with their own Southern identity. And he asks, why is this the case? Because, he says, the South has always been a land deeply planted with those peculiar Christian sensibilities at the very heart of Orthodoxy. True, the term Orthodoxy, correct belief, seems rather to appeal to parochial Puritan strictures, but in action, Orthodoxy has never been the legalistic faith of the American Northeast, a land so deeply concerned with minor disagreements with people hundreds of miles away of their farms and hearths. Rather, it is a faith deep-seated in tradition and preserved inheritance, concerned with the spread of the gospel by example rather than by armed proselytization. The history is demonstrative. While the Puritans carried their faith to Dixie on bayonets and in carpet bags, Orthodoxy sought out a fine and private place in the household of Colonel Ludwell and was content to wait until the time was right to go further beyond. And, this has often been said, you know, the South believes in a quiet commitment to faith, or at least the traditional South. And so Orthodoxy finds that in the ancient traditions of the South. And I think that's important. You know, when you look at the Southern political tradition, just leave us alone. Leave us alone. Orthodoxes, you know, just leave us alone. We just want to worship. We have a quiet commitment, a devotion to our faith. We're not trying to convert everyone right away. When the time comes, we will. But we're not going to stab you in the heart if you do not convert. And so this is that puritanical zeal, very much made up the New England mind. We're going to convert, you convert to us, to our way of thinking, our worldview, or you die. And Southerners have never really been that way. And we had that piece a few weeks back on John C. Calhoun, anti-imperialist. It says, Southerners have never been a convert or die group of people. We'll just leave, and you can have what you want. And I think that's important to understand and why Orthodoxy makes sense for the South. Borthwick says, historically, Southerners have known the suspicion. Much of the moneyed and landed class of Southern society before the war recognized the necessity of replacing chattel slavery with superior moral and economic system. Aside from the principal's objections to expanding federal power and the disregard for the Constitution shown by the inaugural Republican administration, the driving motivation to secession was an intelligent and rational fear that radical and immediate emancipation, with no steps taken for economic or educational preparation of the emancipated, would result in social chaos and economic collapse. The former slaves would be thrown into an economy in the throes of violent change and forced to find a place in a society which itself had not been educated or prepared to receive this new population. Such changes had historically always occurred gradually, and people had peacefully adapted to the new reality. And even then, there had been hiccups. So again, it had to be a different type of society, a different type of change. And so he talks about hospitality and propriety. And Orthodox Christians believe in those things. And that's what makes a Southern tradition important. And so he concludes by saying, this loyalty to the writings of the fathers and the earliest councils of the church, preserving their original meaning and regarding every new interpretation with deep suspicion, is elemental to orthodoxy. Originalism of this sort is hardly foreign to the South. Indeed, the driving force behind the South's legal identity is precisely this idea. The loyalty to the U.S. Constitution among Southerners, past and present, has been informed by their desire to preserve the intention and meaning of the founding documents of the United States and the intentions of the founding fathers. Orthodoxy is a faith driven by a similar desire to see the intention and the meaning of the Church Fathers preserved against new interpretations and broad readings of the original text by contemporary theologians. And speaking of the history of Orthodoxy, one could easily mistake it for the South as a nation. It has suffered in silent dignity during this time, waiting for God to vindicate the truth. It has approached change with extreme caution, knowing the importance of preserving the original intent of its founding documents and teachers. Its culture has been preserved through the living of its tradition through custom and customary behavior. Finally, despite its openness, it is either misunderstood or simply unknown to most outsiders. This is a wonderful piece. And so it points out how there are a tremendous amount of similarities between Orthodox Christianity and the Southern tradition, which really is an Orthodox tradition. And so this brings us into the 20th century and this piece on Claude Kitchen. Now, most people have probably never heard of Claude Kitchen. He was a member of the House of Representatives from North Carolina. And this is the most misrepresented and misunderstood period in Southern history. I firmly believe it. It's the New South period in the late 19th, early 20th century. Because what you get is, well, all these Southerners just wanted to be, you know, New England Hamiltonians. It's simply not true. They were just all big businessmen. The Democrat Party and the Republican Party were the same in the late 19th century. Again, simply not true. At least in their base. Now, we did talk about Tom Watson last week saying we've got the twins, right? So he was criticizing the Democrats and the Republicans as being the same. But that's when they were eventually co-opted. The core of these parties was not the same. Particularly when you start talking about the South. And the South did have a resurgence in the Woodrow Wilson administration. And so you had anti-imperialists out of the South. Now, not many. So you still had this old Southern anti-imperialist tradition. You didn't have many of them. Kitchen was one of them. But Southerners had generally accepted the martial spirit of the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century, because Southerners had always been very martial people. And again, they wanted to be accepted. The Spanish-American War, World War I, was a chance for Southerners to be brought back in the Union. And they talked about this. And then after the war was over, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. They were still criticized, still picked on, still the punching bag, still the insignificant other in American history, the section that always needed to be beat up on and remade. So when you look at Claude Kitchen, this piece is written by Richard Gamble, who's a professor at Hillsdale College. When you look at Claude Kitchen, and you look at his domestic policy. Now, his foreign policy, again, was very much anti-Wilson expansionism. And when you look at the things that he wanted, as Gamble says, like his father, he defended the agrarian tradition, resisted the pro-industrial vision of Henry Grady's New South, allied himself with the Bryan wing of the Democratic Party, and favored much of the populist agenda, especially currency reform and an end to the protective tariff. And so this is the key to understanding these early 20th century Democrats. When you look at the legislation that filtered out of the Wilson administration, the Underwood Tariff, the Clayton Antitrust Act, the Glass-Steagall Act, when you look at that type of legislation, all those things were written by Southerners. And what they were doing is trying to use the apparatus of the federal government to ensure that the agrarian tradition could somehow still have ascendancy in America. Henry D. Lamar Clayton, who wrote the Clayton Antitrust Act, again, an understudied person. But Clayton was the son of Henry D. Lamar Clayton, the Confederate general, who was also president of the University of Alabama. And what he spoke quite a lot about this. He's from Eufaula, Alabama. And he spoke about the fact that the South, or the farmers in the South, were being underrepresented. And so the idea was to use the general government to strike back at these New England merchants who had struck the South so viciously beginning in the 1860s. These people were impoverished, and what he was trying to use the apparatus of the government to level society, to level the playing field, so to speak, so that Southern farmers had a chance. And myself in particular has written several pieces on the New South for the Abbeville Institute, because I think it is an essential part of Southern history that we need to understand more of. Because most Southerners are not rejecting the Old South in terms of the political principles behind it or agrarianism. They weren't rejecting that at all in the New South period. Most Southerners, I mean, Tom Watson, nice example of this, were interested in a Jeffersonian worldview, a Jeffersonian economy. And so you have people like Clayton and Glass-Steagall. I mean, the Glass-Steagall Act was designed to limit the influence of banking getting in bed with the federal government. That was the whole point. You had the Pujo Commission, which criticized the Federal Reserve, or what became the Federal Reserve, because they said it lines itself to business and government get in bed together. This is going to be disastrous. Arsène Pujo of Louisiana. So you have this very important intellectual strain, and I think it's hard for people to get that, because Woodrow Wilson, who though he was born in the South, had abandoned, as Ryan Walter said, had abandoned the South, but he did bring in a lot of these Southerners during his time as president, and they were writing a lot of legislation. And it wasn't progressive like a New England or a Midwestern type of progressivism. It was populist in the Southern tradition of using the government to try to get back at New England, to try to ensure that Southern agrarians still had a role in this government. The income tax was that way as well. Well, let's go tax these rich New England merchants, industrialists, who have gotten fat and happy off the general government anyways, so we're going to take it from them now. So I think that's one way of looking at the New South and looking at this period, this early 20th century period. Southerners were dominating the government, and they were trying to use that government to the benefit of the South. Of course, one of the important parts of this piece is Kitchen's opposition to World War I, or American entrance into World War I. Even though once the United States was in, Kitchen supported Wilson's war measures. But he understood that the war was not really part of the American political tradition. It was going to be a bad idea for the United States to get involved in a foreign war that had no real benefit for the United States. And he was right about that. So when you think about the American political tradition, think about the South in that. You've got the Jeffersonian tradition, the dedication of federalism. You've got the religious component of the South, which is still, the most religious area of the United States, and orthodoxy, or at least, this is not to advocate orthodoxy, but that commitment to tradition is very important in the South. And so we shouldn't forget that. So Clyde Wilson talked about that with evangelicals, of course, looking at and how they've been abandoned. And Orthodox Christianity tries to hang on to this tradition. If we don't start recognizing the South, as Yarbrough says, it won't end well for the United States. We have to start recognizing the importance of the South and the Southern political tradition in America today in order to keep what is, if anything, is left of America around. It's important to understand where the South fits into that. Until next time, good day.